I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When Kansas State Senator Barbara Boyer announced she was changing her party affiliation from Republican to Democrat, she made national headlines. Some of her colleagues in Topeka, though, were a little less surprised. Today, Johnson County's newest Democratic state senator. I'll ask why she couldn't stay in the grand old party and what impact her decision will have on state house politics. Then learn about one of Kansas City's finest but most rarely viewed folk art collections. It's not just an assortment of sculptures, ceramics, and toys. It's a vehicle for bridging generations and cultures. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. She was a Republican for 43 years, with 10 of those spent as a state lawmaker representing Northeast Johnson County. But now State Senator Barbara Boyer is a Democrat, fed up, she says, with a president named Trump and with her former party's stances on LGBTQ issues, particularly transgender rights. It's been almost a week since the senator made her announcement, and now she joins us from Washington, D.C., where she's attending a public health policy conference. Senator, welcome back to Up to Date. So nice to have you here.
Great to be here, Steve. Thank you.
How tough of a call was this for you, Senator?
From an intellectual place, it was very easy in that it supports my deep moral convictions, viewpoints. Mm-hmm. From being identified as something not only for 43 years registered that way, but from a lifelong perspective, being raised by moderate Republican parents, it was much more challenging deep internally to say, boy, I'm changing my identity, but a good thing.
I was going to say, you are changing identities in a sense. You had been a Republican, as I said, for 43 years. That's a long time.
It's a very long time. And this is not something I would say most legislators ever are faced with. And I think that's a good thing for me. I have known that there was what I would call a split in the Republican Party my whole life, and I've always identified it as myself as a moderate Republican, which seems to be, and why I left, a very different title than what is now a Republican that's following the Trump agenda.
Hmm. I assume you have been wrestling with this for a while, and I'm wondering how long.
Always a question of how can you be the most effective, Steve, in what you're doing in the world. I am a legislator, so I've always questioned how can I best represent the people of my district. And so really, if it was just me, this probably would have happened a long time ago. Not necessarily. I have really believed that the moderate Republican voice needed to be heard. And I have tried as a legislator for 9 years to help the party move to a more central location, shall we call it, on the bell curve. And I've failed at that. It is not. It's moving further and further right. So it's time to recognize that, as for me, I wasn't successful in that, and say, where can I best serve? And Democratic Party certainly represents that opportunity.
The party is moving farther and farther right, the Republican Party. Why is that? What's going on in Kansas that has caused the party to go as far rightward as it has?
In my estimation, there has been an effort for more than 30 years of precinct committee member by precinct committee member of conservative Republicans running for those seats and taking control of the party platform and taking control of special elections. And so it's not like it happened yesterday. I think a real dividing point, though, came in the party when it supported Donald Trump and continues to in his presidency, and no one is speaking out calling him into question and what he's saying and how he's doing it to say, maybe we need to modify this.
Tell me about President Trump. I mean, what is it exactly that he does or has done that troubles you as much as it does?
His bullying of people would be a start. Mm-hmm. At just his overall demeanor and the way he treats others, it doesn't represent leadership to me in any sense, whether it be president of the United States or a teacher in a school. But certainly as president of the United States, this constant tweeting out of things that don't necessarily make sense or are calling people liars or other inappropriate things, and that connected to his way of trying to enact policy and the whole methodology of this nature of win at all costs, I'm right, everybody else is wrong, that is translating down into, for instance, the Kansas legislature, certainly from the Republican leadership.
Is there bullying in the Republican leadership today that maybe wasn't there 5 or 10 years ago?
Yes. And I can't speak. I've been there 9 years. It has progressively gotten worse. And very definitely this last year, for instance, it used to be that we had decorum rules. And I was called a Nazi on the floor of the Senate by a fellow senator. And leadership did not speak out and say that is not a proper behavior. That would be an example. But then we see Senate President Weigel now changing committee chairmanships in order to block what's going on with the governor-elect and saying to people, if you don't support my agenda, you will no longer be a committee chair. Jeff Longbein, senator from Emporia, no longer is chairman of financial institutions and insurance. He said no.
And that's the Trump effect, you're saying?
I think it's related. When it happens at the top, it's easy to emulate that. So I would say the two are related. There's no way to absolutely say that's the absolute only reason, but it certainly appears to be a connection, and it certainly has gotten worse.
Why aren't there more Republicans in Kansas who are willing at times to stand up and check the president on his statements that I think almost everyone would agree at times are very controversial? Why don't more Republican leaders stand up to that more often? What's going on?
I can't answer that question. That's been one of my challenges. Where are the people who are in office? Where is their leadership on this issue? To me, it is the emperor has no clothes fable being lived out in real life. I'm not willing to be a person who won't stand up and say what is right, in my opinion. But each person needs to take responsibility for that. If I could figure out the reason why, I think I'd, win a prize or whatever. But none of us have the answer to that. But I certainly am willing to be a person to stand up. I would say, Steve, that many people are fearful for their reelections. And for me, I serve to serve at the moment. If I'm doing the right thing, I believe I will be reelected. And if not, it's time for me to go anyway because the people want someone else. I'm very comfortable with that. It's about the here and now and not about me in 2 years or 5 years or 25, however many it would be. I'm not in it for the career politician move. It's about serving in the today's world what needs to be done.
Donald Trump won Kansas by some 20 points, right? So maybe that's a factor in the mixture you're suggesting.
Very likely, and certainly other districts reflect different value systems. Certainly in Northeast Johnson County, and you're in my district, that it very heavily has gone for a Democratic president, Obama, both times. Recently, obviously in the governor's election, Laura Kelly was overwhelmingly elected out of the Northeast Johnson County sector. So this isn't something that's massively changed in my district. It's always been a very moderate thinking group of people.
Senator Barbara Beaulieu of Kansas is my guest. She represents a district in Northeast Johnson County. She just switched from the Republican to the Democratic parties. What about the Republican Party and its stand on LGBTQ issues, Senator? That was also something that troubled you greatly. What frustrated you there?
Well, numerous things. One, the discriminatory policy positions they take, but specifically, this last year, the party adopted a part of their platform that stated, man created only man and woman, or something along that line. And that is, people want to say, well, that's absolutely the truth. But if you have studied medicine like me and embryology, there are all kinds of different ways sexuality is expressed phenotypically and genotypically, your genes and what you look like. And there are, you can be XX, XY, XYO, XO, XYY, all these different combinations. And then that's just your genetics. Then you have all these other factors that can influence your sexuality. So I don't think that should be an issue other than making sure people are protected. That we should be worrying about in the legislature.
The Republican Party stand on this issue, you have said, that was your last straw.
It really was. And I just said that this place, it has gone out of control. And then became the time to really soul search and figure out, is this the best way to serve and how? And there were elections and all these other things get in the way. But bottom line, and then when being removed from my committee vice chairmanship, seeing everybody else being removed, and this notion of that the Republican verbiage now is we're blocking the governor, that's our goal. I just cannot support that.
You were removed from your committee after you endorsed Democrats.
Tom Nierman.
Tom Nierman. Okay.
Yes, is who I gave a public endorsement for. And then Laura Kelly as well.
And Susan Weigel, the Senate president, stripped you of your committee assignment after that.
Of my vice chairmanship and other temporary or interim committees that, well, bottom line, yes, all of that. So, and then, again, she's doing it to other people as well. So I'm not alone.
So did you lose sleep over this thing, this decision?
I struggled just because it's just a huge change, but not because I don't believe in what the Democratic Party represents. I support that in the majority. Is every single thing exactly how I want it? Of course not. Is there a spectrum of people like there are on the right? Yes, there are also what you would call the far left. I understand all that. But when I sat down and looked at both party platforms, when you look at them side by side and see that, for me, anti-gun violence is a huge issue. Women's right to choose is a huge issue. Expanding Medicaid is a huge issue. Appropriately treating and not discriminating against LGBTQ people is a huge issue. And the list just keeps going on and on and on.
Right.
And it becomes clear it's time to make the change. My votes, and it's very important to say, my votes aren't going to change whether I have a D or an I, R or an I, or anything else after my name. I represent my district and will always vote for what's best, as to the best of my ability, for them. Not about what either party is just supporting at the time.
No, usually when you make a big decision like this, you get a feeling in your gut once you've made the call about whether you did the right thing or not. How has this one felt to you?
Fabulous. Just fabulous. And one of my exciting things is, for the first time when I run in 2020, I will have a party supporting me. I have never had that. The Republicans always fought to get me unelected, to have a conservative in, and the Democrats wanted a Democrat in. So I think that in and of itself speaks for some real issues and problems we're having in the state of Kansas.
Again, State Senator Barbara Beaulieu is my guest. She just switched from the Republican to the Democratic parties last week in the state. How have your fellow Republicans reacted to this, Senator?
There are many that I haven't heard from as far as at least colleagues in the legislature, although I have been pleased by some of the people who have reached out to me just saying, I support your decision because you're doing what you need to do, and that's how we should be, how we should behave in the legislature. Constituent-wise, I would say 98% of what I have heard back is supportive. Very few people have been critical, and those that have been already were critical. This nothing changed in that sense. And most people, their statements are, just thank you for standing up and trying to do the right thing. We need that kind of leadership in this country at this time. People want to see people standing up and saying, what you're doing is not okay, whatever it may be, and taking control of situations when others are acting out in a way that we as a civil society shouldn't be accepting of.
And maybe it's not surprising that Senate President Susan Weigel had a reaction to this. She said, you have a voting record more liberal than some Democrats. It's no shock, she said, that she joined the party of Nancy Pelosi. The only surprise is that she didn't end her facade of being a Republican sooner.
I found that a very disappointing statement.
Because?
I have been a moderate Republican all my life, and I will stand by those values and support other moderate Republicans in this world. It is not a facade to be a moderate Republican. It is a fact to be a moderate Republican. And changing parties, for me, I would have wished my colleague well in making their decision and said, onward we go. There's no reason to be mean or bitter or critical of any behavior I've had in the past. And certainly Susan Weigel knows that the state has benefited from having my expertise, knowledge, and commitment to good public policy in both the House and the Senate. And it shouldn't matter. If on her side, her only goal is to follow her own agenda and to try to block everything, then no, I wouldn't be welcome on that team, but I don't want to play on that team.
I was going to say, in her statement, there's no sense of disappointment here, which makes me wonder, is there still room for moderate Republicans in the Kansas Republican Party?
That will remain to be seen. That's all I can say. I certainly tried it for my life, and it is not working for me.
Yeah.
Other people will have to assess that themselves. We all do that. Usually it's not so public. And many people, many people who have contacted me have said, I changed a year ago, I changed 2 years ago, I'm changing now. And some are saying I'm staying a Republican, not because I support the conservative Republican agenda or Trump, but I want to be able to vote in the primary and affect whether a moderate or a conservative wins a race. So there are a lot of reasons we do what we do and follow what we follow, and we get to choose those things in our democracy. Isn't it beautiful?
What's been Governor-elect Laura Kelly's response here, Senator, since you made your announcement?
She has been very supportive because she needs people like me who know healthcare policy to be present in the Senate and functioning on the Public Health and Welfare Committee. And as I understand it, our new chair, as appointed by Susan Weigel, will be Senator Gene Sullentrop from Wichita. And his background is he is a franchisor of pizza restaurants, which he's a very astute businessman, is my understanding. I do not know what he knows about healthcare. I certainly, to my knowledge, don't remember him ever being at one of our committee meetings, but I could be wrong. Anyway, I think it's important for people who have expertise in areas to be able to lead for the state. It is what Kansas people vote for and why we have a citizen legislature.
I'm visiting with Senator Barbara Beaulieu of Kansas. One of the big issues in Kansas this year will be this whole idea of expanding Medicaid. You favor that. You said as much in our conversation here. Governor-elect Kelly favors that. As you see it today, Senator, what are the odds of that getting signed into law next session?
I can't speak to the odds, but the complexities start with both majority leaders in the House and Senate. Senator Jim Denning and Representative Dan Hawkins are elected to those offices, and they both have been very clear in their statements that they will not support Medicaid expansion, period, and they control what goes on to each chamber's floor for votes. So even if it would manage to get out of a committee, which, again, the chairs of the committees, certainly on the Senate side, was appointed specifically to block ever having a Medicaid expansion bill come, those are the kind of things that are going to make it difficult. Are there ways around it? Possibly. And certainly we have a governor that really, really understands the need for our citizens in our state to be healthy and have access to care.
Hey, do you expect ultimately other Republicans to join you in switching from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party? Other Republican lawmakers from Johnson County, I'm thinking of Senator Dinah Sykes, Representative Stephanie Clayton, have hinted that they might be switching as well. What do you expect to happen here?
I do not know. I absolutely trust both of those women to make the best decision for the way that they represent their people and how they can do that best. So if their decision leads them to that, great. And if it doesn't, great. I've always worked with them. I always will. And no matter what letter they have behind their name, I know they will always be working for the best for their constituents.
Now, you've mentioned here today that you were stripped of your position as vice chairwoman of the Senate Health Committee. You're a retired physician. Do you expect to get back on that committee as a Democrat? Is that a possibility?
Very much so. And I wouldn't be surprised if I was made the ranking Democrat, which means I will be able to participate on the conference committees, which ultimately have significant power to influence bills.
Yeah. Hey, how do you think Republicans will react to working with a Democratic governor for the first time in 8 years here?
I think very positively, at least the ones that want to work together. Laura is very approachable. Excuse me. Governor-elect Kelly is very approachable and has always worked across aisles, across ideologies, across whatever it takes to get good public policy moving forward. And not only that ability, but also her very deep knowledge of both the budget, because she served on appropriations for years, and her involvement in the CanCare Oversight Committee and all other. She knows government and so can help lead it well. So the good news, she'll be transparent, she'll be open, her door will be open, she will be eager to talk and try to work things out in the best way possible. So it makes me excited.
I'm curious, Senator, is there talk in the Senate about curtailing Laura Kelly's authority, maybe not unlike what we just saw up in Wisconsin, where Republican lawmakers there worked to undercut the incoming Democratic governor there? Is that talk sort of in the mix right now?
No, there is not talk of that because the votes are not there, particularly on the House side. Even though the House has become more conservative overall, in the Republican side of it, there is still a coalition and the majority coalition in the Democratic representatives and the moderate Republican representatives joining together. They have more than the 63 votes needed to pass anything.
How about on the Senate side, Senator?
It would be close, and so I don't know what the answer would be. I have not heard of trying to block things from a law perspective. But again, if you don't have the votes in the House, it doesn't matter what the Senate does because you can't put it into law. And finally, the governor can veto the law. So it's done.
Now, Republicans in Kansas are also talking about starting over on school finance. You know, a lot of us thought that issue had been all but dealt with last session, all you had to do this year was sort of raise the ante a little bit more based on the state Supreme Court ruling. But now Republicans are saying, we want to start over again. At least that's how I'm understanding their rhetoric at this point. What do you see happening there, and how do you feel about it?
I have heard as well that there will be an attempt to redo the school funding bill that we put forward. I am not at all surprised. I predicted that would happen because I was on the committee that the Special Education Funding Committee mm-hmm. on the Senate side, and the Senate bill had quite a number of differences from the House bill. And so that would be true anytime a bill fails and you come back to the table, that what your side wanted would be put back on the table again. So this is not surprising to me. The Supreme Court didn't say we must follow what we've already put in place. They said, if you choose to follow this route, then to reach and make this bill acceptable to us, you must put in inflation values to increase what you're funding schools. But it didn't say you couldn't do something else mm-hmm. as well. And so that's where the controversy comes in. I don't know. I'd have to see what's being put out there. I personally, if it comes down where they're going to start putting in issues about vouchers and taking public money away from public education, I could not be supportive of that. If there's some other little tweak that maybe makes it better for students, I could be supportive of that. But the less we change things, the easier or the more likely it will be that it gets past the Supreme Court and can go into effect so our students can be funded appropriately, like we haven't been right. doing for the last nearly 20 years.
Yeah. That's Kansas State Senator Barbara Beaulieu, who just switched from the Republican to the Democratic parties, joining us from Washington today. Senator, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for your explanation here, and we'll look forward to seeing you back in Topeka.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you, Steve, and may the best happen in Kansas.
Coming up, we learn about one of the most rarely viewed folk art collections in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. You can hear previous episodes of the program at kcur.org/uptodate, including my conversation yesterday with the smart money experts about the future of Social Security. And tomorrow we want to hear from you. Which homes and neighborhoods do you think have the best residential Christmas light displays? And we'll ask a lighting specialist to share some tricks of the trade. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, when it comes to defining folk art, even the International Museum of Folk Art admits there is no one definition. Included in its attempt to describe it are these characteristics. It is traditional, it reflects shared cultural aesthetics and social issues. It may be decorative or utilitarian. It is handmade and it may be self-taught. If you want something more definitive, you have the chance to see some wonderful examples of what folk art is at a display being shown at the Kansas City Public Library's central location. The piece are from a collection owned by the Mattie Rhodes Center here in Kansas City. Joining me now to explain the story behind this collection and the current exhibition are Jenny Mendez. She's Director of Cultural Arts for the Mattie Rhodes Art Center. Jenny, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Olivia Clanton is a Kansas City Art Institute grad and curator of this exhibit. Olivia, nice to have you.
Hi, thanks.
Lori Hamilton's a member of the Mattie Rhodes Original Hand in Hand Folk Art Collection Steering Committee. Lori, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how do you three define folk art? I mean, is there a definition that you use, Olivia? What should we be thinking about here?
Well, my focus on my interest in folk art is that it has the kind of magical power of talking about really complex issues while still being super relatable.
How does it talk about complex issues?
Because it's rooted in culture, and it's the pieces made in the collection are I don't know how to say this, like
it just kind of complicated.
Yeah.
Let me try to help you.
Yeah. Jump in here. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Lori.
The piece of artwork is not just an object. It's really a window into the life of the maker, the life of the maker's community.
Well, there you go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
The materials in that community's region, and the history passed down generally from family members.
Yeah. I like that. That sound good to you, Jenny?
Yeah, it sounds great. I mean, folk art to me is such a connector piece, you know, culturally, from one culture to another, for the viewer to be able to see a piece from another culture and find out about it,
mm-hmm.
you know, find out about them.
That's the whole point, right?
Right, about the maker to just as simply just about something that they would never experience or know.
Right.
Whether it's a textile piece, whether it's a handmade paper mache piece to a wood carved piece, you know, all these things are so, you know, just tangible. And then when you add color, which a lot of folk art is so colorful, that speaks to me personally.
Right.
But I know to a lot of people, either color is one way or the other, right? It's like too intense or don't, you know, but folk art speaks so much with not only the color, but just with everything, the background that comes with it.
Yeah. You know, Lori, I want to spend a little time tracing the paths of this collection of folk art. It started with a woman named Alice Ann Biggerstaff, who worked as an artist at Hallmark for 37 years. When she wasn't working there, what was she doing?
After retirement, Alice Ann moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico. But previous to that, through most of her life, she traveled all over the world. She was in North Africa, she was in island communities, Central America, Mexico, and she had this great interest in just talking to people, seeing people, sharing with people. So she bought all of her life, and when she moved from Kansas City to Santa Fe, she moved a lot of this folk art collection with her. It was astonishing how much it was.
I was going to say, how many pieces did she wind up collecting?
At the time that it was gifted to Mattie Rhodes in 1995, it was 1,366 pieces. Today, it's certainly over 1,500.
But even though she moved to Santa Fe, she didn't forget Kansas City. How so?
She was a Kansas Cityan. She loved Kansas City. She would come back and visit. She had 37 years at Hallmark, many, many friends here.
And who got the collection eventually back up here in Kansas City?
A group of friends with Hand in Hand. Hand in Hand was started to promote cultural understanding and to find a home for it. And although there were some organizations and institutions in Santa Fe that wanted to cherry pick it, it was Alice Ann's desire to keep it en masse. And we thought, let's bring it back to Kansas City, which was becoming more diverse.
Ah. And what did Hand in Hand do with the collection?
Hand in Hand helped gather it, authenticate it, identify it, inventory it, raise money for it, and then bring it to Kansas City. It started as a field of interest fund at the Community Foundation, kind of a placeholder, until more and more we began to work with Mattie Rhodes, and that's the eventual home as it is today.
I was going to say, Jenny, how did Mattie Rhodes get involved here?
Well, I made great friends with some amazing artists from Hallmark and amazing people with Hand in Hand. So Lori, along with a few others, just kind of built that connection. So really it started with Day of the Dead. So Day of the Dead exhibit, Dia de los Muertos, that we do at our space that we've done for 22 years. So I'd say a little over 22 years ago, Day of the Dead, along with a women's show that we did, we had made friends and we decided, oh, you know, we could bring some of the collection as part of the exhibits that we provide. And we did a show at Central Park Gallery, which is now the Webster House. But back in those days, you know, over 20 years ago, we did an exhibit. It was called Mujeres Fuertes, which is strong women. And some of the folk art pieces from Hand in Hand were exhibited, curated from Lori and maybe a couple others. And we were able to, and we got this crowd of people that we knew that were in love with these wonderful pieces that we were able to bring as part of this exhibit. So we knew that we could grow this. So our Day of the Dead happened. We started doing more exhibits using the folk art collection as kind of a, you know, placeholders to have people like connect, you know, not only with the exhibit of art that we already had or ofrendas or altars that we were having community people do, but there was also actual pieces from a right. collection that we could highlight. So the relationship was just, it made sense. And the hand-in-hand founders, you know, by having a friendship with myself, it became a friendship and a family of Maddie Rhodes and hand-in-hand. Right. And so things just kind of grew from there.
You know, Olivia Clanton, you curated the exhibit for the library. It's the last in this year-long series of exhibitions curated by Art Institute students. Tell us a little bit about the series here and what that was about.
Yeah, so that was from a curatorial studies course I was taking, which was something I was really interested in school. And it was super exciting because our whole end of the semester was to propose a project at the library. And I thought that it was just, it made a lot of sense because everyone going to the library is already at a place of wanting to learn and wanting to relax or right. spend time there. And Maddie Rhodes uses that collection to make educational curriculum from the pieces, which I think is super important to me, mm-hmm. kind of teaching about these cultures through the actual pieces that they come from.
You know, when you're looking, what are you looking for when it comes to choosing the pieces you wound up displaying here?
Yeah, so the collection is huge, and I kind of got a key to the room, and it was amazing to try to kind of...
Overwhelming in some ways.
Yeah, overwhelming. So I basically just chose... There's so many different mediums in the collection. There's like weavings, there's masks, there's sculptures, there's toys. So I basically just chose pieces that would kind of represent the whole collection, kind of fit into this small room in the library.
Mm-hmm. Some people may see folk art as, you know, plain, even childlike, but doesn't it represent the need to create in its purest form? Is that how you see it?
Oh, yeah. Totally. It's so relatable, and we all kind of come from, a lot of us have history and craft, and my grandmother was a quilt maker, and I know a lot of people have really great relationships with things that are made by your hands.
Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about one of the most rarely viewed folk art collections in Kansas City. And I should point out that Jenny, Olivia, and Lori will present Maddie Rhodes and the Indelible Impressions of Art tomorrow, December 19th, at the Kansas City Central Library, 14 West 10th Street, downtown. The program begins at 6:30. Go to kclibrary.org to RSVP. And the Craft Research Lab exhibit of the pieces from the Maddie Rhodes collection will be on display through December 30th. So you have a little bit of time to go visit all these things. Olivia, describe a favorite piece in the exhibit, at least as far as you're concerned.
I think my favorite piece in the exhibit is the Árbol de la Vida. It's a huge, I think it's terracotta piece mm-hmm. that kind of details the history of like getting items that represent you as like an individual within your culture, or your family, mm-hmm. and putting it on the árbol. And we actually did one of the art teachers at the Maddie Rhodes Art Center came in to the library and did a workshop, and everyone that came was able to make a small item that would go on the one tree of life, and that'll actually be at the library.
Do you have a favorite piece too, Lori?
I can't say I have a favorite piece.
Yeah.
Because I've handled these pieces and packed them and unpacked them.
They're like your kids now, right?
I'm very familiar with them, and it is just an honor and a thrill. I know Alisan would love it to know that it's going to be seen, enjoyed again, and it's going to have a home here in Kansas City.
Jenny, do you have a favorite piece?
In the show, actually, I showed this piece to Olivia, and I'm glad she chose it. But it was a Huichol piece that's a yarn painting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know the name of it. You might know it. Do you know it?
I just called it the yarn painting.
Yeah. Oh, it's beautiful.
It's really beautiful.
Keep things simple here.
Yeah. It's a beautiful piece, very colorful, and just has so much intricacy to it. It just takes your breath away.
Mm-hmm. Lori, where did most of the pieces that Alisan collected, where did they come from?
Generally, they came from her travels, but also her shopping. She was a great shopper. She loved to travel with her partner in life, with her friends. She traveled many, many places, and she even bought here in Kansas City. There's a wonderful store in Brookside that is a folk art store, World's Window, and that family is part of Hand in Hand as well. She never stopped buying. She would go stop at the side of the road and buy something.
Can you tell now, based on your time with this collection, what she was drawn to? Are there patterns that have sort of emerged here? Or was it just so eclectic
it's so hard to say, Steve. I think pure expression.
Yeah.
And the makers. Sometimes the makers would be young children, nephews or nieces or grandchildren from someone else.
Yeah.
Or an elderly person that no one was paying attention to. And Alisanne would go up to them and talk to them. She might find something to exchange with them. She was also a big gifter. So she gave a lot of folk art away into the community of her friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm wondering, what materials are found in folk art that are not usually found in other art forms, Olivia? What have you noticed?
I think it's resourcefulness. There's a lot of
That's a pieces. Good word.
Yeah, there's a lot of pieces in the show that are items that are around your house that are really valuable to you or to the maker that that made them. So there's tree branches and, I think just the resourcefulness.
What makes a piece sort of elevate from just being something in a collection to something that's a collectible? Is there anything you can point to?
I'm not sure. Maybe Lori, do you?
I think that would vary. First, mm-hmm. it would be from concept to the actual fulfilling an expression of the concept. It may be a maker. It may be a member of a family. Inside Hand in Hand, we have quite a few pieces from the Aguilar family. The Aguilars are national treasures in Mexico. There were four sisters, terribly jealous of each other. Alisanne would have to hide pieces from the other sister if they came to visit her home.
Wow.
And some of those pieces are really prized today, and some of those sisters aren't here. Or woodcarvers. Woodcarvers in a small city like San Martin in Oaxaca, the state of Oaxaca.
Right.
From someone very famous, but there might be a child who makes something, and that becomes important because it echoes maybe another piece. So it's not one thing.
Jenny, how rare are some of these pieces?
There's a few pieces that I've learned from Lori that are very rare, you know, and it is just really about Alisanne, the things that really spoke to her. And then once we've received the pieces, then we know, like, wow, we can hear about the story. We know about the background of it. And then if it is something that's more rare, then that just brings more, importance to it in all levels, not just a dollar amount. But when I think of rare, I'm thinking of both. I'm thinking of rare, meaning that it may have a higher price tag on it if a collector was looking for it or wanting it. But it also just has more of a, you know, just an impression to it that people would really be drawn to it or not even realize that this artist that is either well known or not well known or from a city that's well known for folk art or not. So it's a lot of different things that really compile that you know, the question and the answer.
Does Mehdi Rhodes continue to sort of add to the collection?
Yes, we just added a couple of pieces from Lori had brought in a beautiful Dia de los Muertos, Day of the Dead piece, and then also an amazing piece of Our Lady of Guadalupe. And these are both clay pieces. And Lori can speak a little bit more on these two particular pieces, but the idea of being able to add to the collection and the gift and what they're, you know, what they're going to be for. Mehdi Rhodes it was broken ground on a capital campaign that we've been doing for a few years now to break ground on a new building that will finally house the Hand in Hand Folk Art Collection with the Mehdi Rhodes Gallery space as one. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to have it on somewhere else because there's just not enough room. The goal was to make sure to finally unite the two. So me as an artist, me as an educator, I can say, look, the folk art is right here. Instead of me having to travel to it and then bring something back, I can use it, and the teachers that we have on staff can have it right at their fingertips instead of, you know, it's kind of away and you have to remind yourself that, oh, I should go and do this, you know.
Lori, where are you finding these pieces that you're adding to the collection?
From my own collection. This should be seen, Steve, as a seed collection. that as a magnet would draw other collectors. There are many folk art collectors and folk art artists inside our own region. If they know that there's a safe place where it can be displayed, where it's cared for, the hope is it would grow from gifts, other gifts, as a magnet.
Yeah. Olivia, how many pieces from the collection will visitors to the library ultimately be able to see here?
Oh, there's a lot. There's probably all in all 30 around. There's a few pieces that are from the Aguilar family that kind of like it's a whole composition, but there's probably at least 15 within that one piece.
And where in the library are these things being displayed?
It's at the Genevieve Goldner Gallery, right when you walk in the main entrance of the library.
You know, Lori, is this what Alice and, you know, Biggerstaff envisioned for her collection, this way that it be shared with the public in the way? I think you've said yes, but that's her goal here.
That wasn't her goal, so I may have given you a misimpression.
Right.
She never meant to start a collection. She was a gatherer. She was a gatherer of people, a gatherer of experience, and she shared everything. So it was really a gathering. And as we neared the time in her life for her to make some end-of-life planning, there was a question about what to do with this. And we discussed this, as she did with many of her other friends, and the goal was to share it in the community that she had come from, which was Kansas City.
And it's important for people to see a collection like this. Why?
Because it opens their eyes and their heart to people all around them. We live in a city with a lot of diversity, and it's only becoming more diverse. Many of us are immigrants, first generation, second generation. It's that cross-cultural understanding. We share celebrations. We share sadnesses. We share markers in life. We share joy. We share sorrow. That's why.
How often are the pieces rotated in and out of the gallery at the Mattie Road Center, Jenny?
We try to rotate them out through different exhibits that we do about 6 or 7 exhibits a year. So within those 6 or 7 exhibits, we try to make a connection with the exhibit that's up. Like, we'll have a women's show in March, and so we'll change out the...
Do you loan them to other museums sometimes?
If we get a call and it makes sense, and it seems like right along the lines of what Hand in Hand would want or what Alice Ann would want, in the idea that we want to stay very much... connected to the idea of what the collection should be and where it should go. So we're very conscientious of that, making sure that it makes sense. And so we've done other shows at other places before, but this is really nice that this was curated specifically by Olivia for the library.
Again, you can see and hear our guests tomorrow evening at 6:30 at the Central Library downtown, the Craft Research Lab exhibit of the pieces from Mattie Rhodes on display through December 30th. Thank you all very much for coming in today. Good to have you all.
Thank you.
You bet. Tomorrow on the show, how a city's density affects its growth and whether Kansas City sits in the sweet spot for both. We'll hear from the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank about that. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Devin Davis. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.